Welcome to the last lecture of supercomputers, architectures of supercomputers, sorry. I probably should silence my mobile phone. Last week we were talking about current systems in Germany, and I would like to finish this overview with a brief overview of systems in Erlangen and in Bavaria. And afterwards I would like to try to give you a glimpse into the future. Actually, when I was looking at my slides, I realized that I should delete some of the slides because traditionally at the end of the term I give an outlook, and much of the outlook was actually already state of the art or even boring state of the art. So that's why I deleted some slides on Power 7 because now we have Power 8. And I deleted some slides on Stampede, which is a system currently set up at the Texas Advanced Computing Center, which is no longer a future system, but a current system. They are already thinking about replacing that. However, let's move back to Erlangen. We have two major systems currently. One is Lima, 500 nodes, about 6,000 Intel Xeon cores, and 40 gigabit InfiniBand. In total, 12 terabytes of RAM. So that's about 2 gigabytes per core. That used to be the ratio for most compute clusters, 2 gigabytes RAM per core. So if you look at some of the other supercomputers, especially the larger machines, you will almost always find this 1-to-2 ratio. This is slowly changing. RAM has become so much cheaper than cores that today in newer systems you might find a ratio of 1-to-3 or 1-to-4. If we look at EMI, which is currently the newest system, you will see that it's got almost the same number of nodes. Right? It's just 60 nodes more. That's not too much of an improvement. It does have almost twice the number of cores, simply because we now have, basically we still have 2 sockets per node, but simply the CPUs we can buy today have more cores, right? If you look at the clock speed, that's interesting because current CPUs are clocked at 2.2 gigahertz, but the previous ones were running at 2.6 gigahertz. So that's just 460 megahertz, if you think about that. But it's still a sizable ratio, right? That's how much percent is this less than the original clock speed? Let's say about 20%. So, yeah, if we then account for the increased number of cores, you will obviously see that still the performance went up, but it's not a factor of 2, it's perhaps a factor of 1.5. And if your code doesn't scale to this number of cores, it probably won't achieve a better performance on EMI. Actually, I think Thomas Zeidel from the High Performance Computing Group did some measurements, and what he came up with was that actually, for their systems, which they are buying, the single thread performance is decaying. So on the previous system, Lima, they had a higher single thread performance than now on EMI. And I think even the system before, Woody, had a higher single thread performance than Lima. So it's actually slightly going down. If you're able to vectorize, if you're able to use multi-threading, if you're able to use multiple nodes, then you should be all right. And of course, if you assume that something is running on a high-performance computing system, then you always assume that it's able to scale. But the reality is that not all codes are able to scale on a single node well. What we can see here is also slightly increased ratio of cores to RAM. And what's interesting is that the system itself is still air-cooled, but the racks themselves have water cooling. So beneath the raised floor, there's a cold water supply. And this is used to cool the back doors of the racks. So the racks themselves are closed. I think we should have some chalk here. If I recall correctly, they always have two compute racks. And besides them, there's a cooling rack. And into this cooling rack, they feed cold water. And by a heat exchanger. This water is being heated up, and what they do with the air is they circulate the air through this heat exchanger and cool the systems with this. So cold air enters the computer rack, is heated up, and is moved back to the heat exchanger. And they do this for both racks. As far as I know, they are already thinking about buying a new system. I'm not sure if anything about that is public yet. So, but one typical problem of this building is actually that the walls are so thick that it's hard to establish any other cooling system. So right now, this cold water cooling is very inefficient because the water is very cold. I think it's somewhere around 9 degrees Celsius. So you can imagine that in the summer, it's very expensive to cool water that low. And there's another problem. If you have such cold water and you have it and you lead it through a raised floor, and the rest of the room is pretty hot, then there will be condensation water forming around the cold water tubes. And they actually had pools of water beneath the cold water supply. And they had to isolate this properly. And apparently that was not so easy, at least not for the manufacturer. I think the system is built by NEC. Okay. Obviously, EMI is not the largest system in Bavaria. The largest system in Bavaria is Supermuc. The name stems from, well, obviously, supercomputer, and MUC stands for the airport. Most people don't think of the airport, but Pumuckl, which is to you from not from Germany, that it was a famous TV series when I was a kid. But yeah, so not everyone would agree that Supermuc is a good name because of Pumuckl, but then again, the predecessors to Supermuc were called HLRB1 and HLRB2. So compared to HLRB, Supermuc is, I think, a perfect name. Does anyone know for which HLRB stands? Bayern. Well, okay, that's good. Yeah, the B obviously stands for Bayern. Yeah, that was good. Hochleistungsrechner Bayern. So that was Hochleistungsrechner Bayern 1 and Hochleistungsrechner Bayern 2. It's always good to spell out such names if you're speaking at an international conference, because the audience will love you for that, especially if you challenge them to repeat what you just said. So what does make Supermuc special? At first, not much. If you look at the performance, we've seen systems with much higher performance. Okay, most of those systems are a bit younger than Supermuc is, but still, I think the fastest system is about 10 times faster than Supermuc. So why would it be still special today? And the reason for that is, it is one of the fastest systems which is just powered by standard CPUs. There are no accelerators in there. You could say that BlueJeans and the K computer are also standard processors in the sense that there is no accelerator, no coprocessor. But what makes, so to express this more precisely, I think this is one of the fastest systems just powered by Intel Xeon processors. No Xeon Phi, no GPU, no vector CPU, just standard x86 CPUs. And the reason why they procured exactly this system is they wanted something their code would run on efficiently, some system they already knew. They did not want another special purpose machine for which it would be very expensive to port the hardware. This is also the reason why they have no GPUs. They wanted their existing codes to run on. They didn't want to port them these applications to they didn't want to port these applications to GPUs, to CUDA. The system itself is built by IBM, and as all IBM machines, it's sort of looking impressive. So if you're standing in front of it, you will say, oh, that is a huge system. LRZ, the Leibniz Rechenzentrum, where this is situated, they wanted to have pictures of Munich on the sides of the racks. If you think about Titan or, well, actually, I think most US machines have pictures on the longer sides of the racks, so to make them look good, right? And usually what they picture is scientific discoveries obtained on the previous machine. So pictures of Munich are probably not scientific discoveries, but LRZ really want them on the sides of the rack. But IBM said, no, you can't do that. That would spoil the look of our system, and of course we need those pictures for marketing, and IBM was strictly against such pictures. So they thought of a compromise, and one idea was to not put these pictures on the sides of the rack and the long sides here, but to just put white outlines on the racks, so that then still the system would be majestic and black and impressive, and LRZ would get their pictures. But apparently someone did not like this compromise, so they have now resorted to putting pictures just here on the short sides. I'm not sure if everyone's happy with this, but apparently this is the solution they chose. Aside from being just a standard system, what's also impressive is the cooling. And I would like to talk about this someone later. I'm not sure if I have... Okay, so I don't have any further slides on the cooling, which is a bit sad. So this is the system's water-cooled, but it's hot water cooling. And how this works is the water cooling gets directly to the CPU. So all heat sinks are equipped with copper pipes. I think even the RAM is being water-cooled. And the difference between cold water cooling, which is used in our building, and hot water cooling is the chips get much hotter. And usually you would say, oh, that's probably not a good idea. You don't want to fry your chips. But it's still cold enough for the chips to operate. I think the maximum temperature is somewhere around 70 degrees for these chips, that the water is cooling them down. And the good thing about having really hot water is you can actually use this for something useful. So for instance, in the winter, you can use hot water to heat the offices. Okay, that's good, right? It's probably not a good idea to put hot water through the offices in summer, so you need some other way to cool the water down then. But what you can still do is you have free air cooling. Maximum temperature assumed in Munich is somewhere around 35 degrees Celsius. And if you have 60 degrees hot water, you can still cool it down with ambient air. So they have chillers on the top of the building. I'm not sure if we will be able to make it to the end of the slides today, so I still have some pictures I could show you for the free air cooling they have set up. And so whichever weather it is, if it's winter, they can heat their offices. In summer, they can still use free air cooling. And actually, their power efficiency for cooling is very, very good. So for every kilowatt hour they spend on computing, they spend about 0.1 kilowatt hour to cool the system, right? So, that's about a ratio of 1 to 10, right? So just 10% of the compute power is needed for cooling. Do you need how much percent of the compute power is needed for cooling here in this building? 200%. That's close. I think it's 150%. So, yeah. So in our building, that would be something along these lines, simply because it's so expensive to use that cold water for cooling. A way to express this is the PUE value. So sometimes compute centers will show you the PUE value. PUE is total power consumption, so compute plus cooling, actually plus network and etc. divided by compute. So for LRZ, this would be 1.1 divided by 1. And for our building, this would be 2.5 divided by 1, something along that line. OK. The system itself has thin and fat nodes. And it's all connected via InfiniBand. So these are thin and fat nodes. Actually, there's just one fat node island. So most of the thin nodes are, most of the compute islands are thin nodes, actually. And I think the rest is actually the storage system, which you can see here. Yeah. So it's pretty much a standard architecture, no fancy special hardware, except for the cooling. I think the cooling system was still new when IBM built it. But as far as I know, this business has now been sold to Lenovo. So. OK, so much for systems in Germany. The rest of the lecture is a brief glimpse into the future. That's always difficult, especially for computer science, especially for manufacturing processes. When I was studying computer science, people told us that, well, one professor said Moore's law will hold on forever because we would be doomed if it didn't. Others said Moore's law is doomed and it won't continue in the next 1 or 2 years. And what we can say today, well, Moore's law is somewhat still true, even though it has changed. But clock speeds are not rising anymore. And I would like to give you a more exact view of this. And what's often seen in the industry is a reference to Dennard scaling. Dennard is the author of a rather important paper from the 1970s. If you want to have a look at this, this link will lead you to there. And basically, what he said was, if we are scaling our CMOS manufacturing processes by a factor of A, whatever this factor A is, for instance, it gets every 18 months, it would double, right? Then this scaling factor, the doubling would be 2, A would be 2. So what we can see then is if our structure sizes shrink, we can see that we need less voltage to drive a transistor. That's good, because lower voltage also often means less power used. Our gate thickness, the oxide layer, gets smaller, so it basically scales with the inverse of A. Channel width and gate width, they all scale with the inverse of A. And the payoff of this is we get higher densities, right? If I can scale my manufacturing processes by a factor of A, then I get basically the squared number of transistors on my die, right? Because they are mostly two-dimensional. I can also clock my CPU higher, and I need less power per clock. So even though I get a higher density, my power consumption per clock per transistor is being reduced, so my power density was constant. This is why why cooling was not so much of a problem until right about the Pentium 4. When the Pentium 4 hit the market, suddenly these 2.something gigahertz were a huge problem. And actually, the first releases of, or the first models, had a tendency to simply burn through because the we had some at the University of Jena. We had a small cluster built of Pentium 4s, and some of the nodes actually burned through because in summer, our air cooling was not quite up to the required levels. So what happened now when we moved beyond 65 nanometers is things did change. So some of this still true. So I think early in the lecture, we were talking already about manufacturing processes, and some of the properties still change. So we, for instance, still get small transistors, but there's some of the properties we can't change. So for instance, the oxide layer here, this is a couple of atoms thick. So it's people in manufacturing actually count the number of the layers of atoms. So you can't make the oxide, you can't much reduce the oxide thickness on the gate. And because you can't do this, the reason why you can't do this is tunneling effects. So electrons might now tunnel from the gate into the channel. And that's not what you want your transistor to do. You want your transistor to isolate the gate from the channel, because otherwise current would flow. So if more electrons are tunneling, you are losing more electrons. That means increased power consumption. So if you can't reduce this thickness, we can't reduce voltage. And if we can't reduce voltage, then my power density is simply no longer constant, because I get a higher density. Actually, I think also this one here, power per clock, is no longer scaling. So I think I need to fix that one too. So yeah, and that's a problem we can see today. So the result is actually an effect which is also called dark silicon. I have more transistors on my die than I can fire simultaneously. Some of the transistors have to remain silent. Or another way to put it is, if I'm using just one of my four cores, I can clock it in higher speed. It just means I don't have the thermal budget to use all my four cores to the same extent, which is interesting, and we'll discuss this concept on the next slides. Actually, what I'm talking now about the CMOS manufacturing or lithography processes, this is all inspired by a talk we had yesterday from Mr. Pille from IBM. So yesterday we had two IBM engineers here for the informatic colloquium, and they were giving us some insights into manufacturing processes and the problems. I think the original title of the talk was something about Power8, but of course they were not able to share some of the more interesting details because they are confidential, of course. However, what they were talking about regarding CMOS manufacturing was still very interesting. So this is how we do lithography today. We have some sort of light source on top of this stack. We have a lens, a mask somewhere in between, water, and the wafer. So the wafer, which is made of silicon, is coated with and then after the lithography process, the coating, which has not been altered by the light, will be washed away. It's all complicated. I don't want to give you a thorough introduction to the whole process of lithography. What I'm trying to draw your attention to is actually, currently this all works with ultraviolet light. So for ultraviolet light, you can still use lenses. The problem is the wavelength, for instance, is somewhere around 190, perhaps 150 nanometers. That's still considered light. However, when I'm trying to create small structures, for instance, for 40 nanometers, that is going to be a problem. Because if the wavelength of the light is larger than the objects I'm trying to project, or the structures I'm trying to project, then I'm going to have a problem. Actually, it has been a problem since a couple of years. So in the beginning, when the wavelength got somewhere into the same order of magnitude as the structures that were being created, what happened was, for instance, the mask would contain such structures, some rectangular areas which should be projected. And on the wafer, the result was that these structures were not as exact. So the corners would be rounded, which is simply an effect of the wavelength and the corners interacting in a funny way. Now, if you need these structures, but your lithography process is giving you these structures, you have a problem. So there are countermeasures to this. So what people did at first was, okay, they realized these corners are our problem, so maybe we can find some alternative shape to draw on the mask to still achieve our result. So one typical way is to extend the corners a bit and to hope that interference of the light with these corners will somehow result in the structures you're seeking. So actually the result, if you use this mask for your wafer, will probably look like this. which is the desired outcome. It's obviously not as easy as I just said, right? It's not just about adding some corners here to the already existing corners. It's not just as simple as adding some spikes. So there are companies whose whole business is to compute the extension of such desired shapes to these shapes so that the lithography process will work. So one of my colleagues was working with a company, Genesis, in Munich, where they were doing exactly this. So you can imagine that you can, with this process of extending the shapes or doing some inverse calculations to avoid rounded corners, you can get to a certain point. But now we are somewhere at the ratio of 1:10 between the desired structure size and the wavelength of the light. Somewhere there has to be a limit, right? At least people are getting more and more problems. So another solution to this is to not draw all the structures in one go, but to draw just half of the structures and then use another mask for the other half, which is slightly tilted. So they use multiple passes to draw all the structures for one layer. So even this has problems. So there are a couple of follow-up ways of how to, I'm sorry, the slide looks even worse than on my screen. I'm trying to explain this to you. That's just a shameless copy of the slide we saw yesterday. So what does this tell us? One of the competing technologies for the next generation lithography process is extreme ultraviolet lithography. How does this work? So if you could see what this picture actually is, this is a light source. The light source is not just a single laser, but it's actually a carbon dioxide laser, which is fed through a refracting mirror. And what is in the center? Oh yeah, I think they are heating up air to generate a plasma. And this plasma will generate extreme ultraviolet light, and this is refracted by the mirror here. So this is the light source, and they use this for lithography, which, as I said, is not very, very easy. It's complicated. The whole device here has about the size of a caravan. So it's really large. It's expensive. It was extreme ultraviolet lithography is not a new idea. That's being thought about since, I think, even decades. So when I was studying, that was already in subject of research. Do you know why this still is a subject of research and not something deployed by the industry? Why can't you just swap out your traditional ultraviolet light by such a light source? If we go back to the traditional lithography, this is actually called immersion lithography because there's water here. If you have ever used a microscope, you perhaps know that sometimes you immerse what you're trying to look at in water so that the display is crisper. And that's basically the same. They use this water to guide the light. And the problem is, with extreme ultraviolet light, you can't use lenses anymore. And you can't use water because that would just block the extreme ultraviolet light, or you would lose even more light than you're already losing in optics right now. So basically, you can't just use your standard optics, which you are used to, any longer. So it's not as simple as just swapping out the light source, but you have to swap out the whole optics. And this is what makes extreme ultraviolet lithography so expensive. You have to swap out much more of the tool stack. It's not an easy integration. It's very, very complicated. So it's making progress, but I think it's still not ready for the market as far as I know. So there are a couple of other problems. So for instance, the power consumption, resist line roughness, mask black defects, such which I don't understand actually, optics lifetime, that's all stuff the hardware engineers have to care about, which is apparently still a problem. So theoretically, they could build chips with this system, but it's not competitive on the market. It's very expensive. Of course, there are other technologies. For instance, the MAPR project, which stands for, or which is using multiple e-beams for a maskless lithography. So let's dissect this name. What is e-beam? That's an electron beam. So they are basically no longer using really light for the lithography process, but they are using streams of electrons, which they just fire on the wafer. And that's, of course, really expensive. So do you know any other technology which used electron beams? I think it was the CRT, or the traditional TV or monitor. Basically, that was just an electron gun, which you were pointing at your face. Right? So there was a layer of phosphor, and if the electrons hit the phosphor, it would light up. And in a way, so if, I think that's a very similar concept. In a way, they are, the idea for lithography is simply to direct this stream of electrons to the wafer exactly where you want your structures to end up. So that's very exact. And the problem is you have to traverse the whole wafer. And so it takes a lot of time. And if you think that compute chips are a mass market, where each fab has to produce thousands of chips or tens of thousands of chips per day, then you probably can imagine that you don't want one single electron beam to traverse the whole chip or the whole wafer, because that takes days. Right? So the idea for the MAPR project is to simply have multiple e-beams. And if you have a lot of e-beams, you can probably achieve the same speed. But then again, cost is a factor, right? These electron accelerators are expensive. You have to do all this in very clean conditions, no dust. So again, this is expensive from a maintenance point of view. And again, it's swapping out the whole tool stack, right? So it's a huge change. And if you know anything about how people are building fabs, that is close to witchcraft. So actually, the manufacturers typically choose one fab to integrate a new process first. And then they build all the other fabs exactly like the first fab. So if the first fab, for instance, has a building, and this building has a pillar somewhere, so let's view this from the top. Let's say here is, that's again the bad part of the board. Let's say there's a pillar, and they need to route a pipe around this pillar. And they are trying to copy the whole manufacturing process in another fab which does not have this pillar. Then sometimes they will still route the pipe around the imaginative pillar, so just to be sure that the liquid moving here has the same condition as in the previous fab. I'm not making this up. So, as I said, it's close to witchcraft. Sometimes you just do things to be on the sure side because it's all so expensive. This curve in the pipe is not expensive, so you just build it in to be on the sure side. And this is one reason why manufacturers are typically not too keen to integrate completely new technology, which costs literally billions, tens of billions, just to build and not even to research, if they're not sure that this will work properly. And if you go back 20 years, you would see dozens of competitors on the manufacturing market. And today, this has reduced to half a dozen, I think. Right. There was Global Foundries. There still is Global Foundries, which was previously AMD. There's IBM. There's Intel. There's Samsung. I think TSMC is still a manufacturer. But there it ends slowly, right? There are not too many more on the market. And even these manufacturers have to pool research resources to get to the next node. So I think Intel is still operating just on themselves. They don't have partners. I think IBM does the same, but I think the others have pooled their resources. So we have now been talking about the basically the structures which we need for the transistors. But even if we solve those, one thing we tend to forget is the actual wires, right? People are obsessed with these structure sizes for transistors. And what you, so this could be a spacecraft from, for instance, your game, Constantine. Or it is actually an SRAM cell. This is part of a chip. An SRAM cell would be something which stores one byte in a cache. Or it is, not one byte, one bit in a cache, or one bit in a register file. And these dots here, which you can't really see because my slide is so badly, these points here are the actual transistors. And all the rest here is just wires to drive the transistors. So today, we spend much more space and also sometimes energy on the wires themselves than on the actual transistors. And even if we shrink those transistors, the wires still have to somewhere remain the same size, simply because voltage doesn't change any longer. So we need these wires need to be capable to deliver the current we need. Next problem is interconnect. So I think I did illustrate this somewhere in the last lectures. If you somewhere have manufactured a chip, you still need to wire it to the outside. And the traditional approach was to just apply these bonding wires to the frame of the chip. So, and have the compute part or the memory part inside. And to apply these bonding wires, there are still machines to do that. Previously, people had to do this by hand. And I think still for experimental chips, which are not manufactured in a huge volume, still people sometimes have to do this manually, although assisted by robots, because the structure sizes are simply too small. Today, what people can do is they can apply so-called micro bumps. These micro bumps are simply applied to the surface of the chip. So you can have, today, you can have connections everywhere on the chip, but just on the surface. And if you consider that your chip is made up from multiple layers, and power consumption happens in every layer, and also you can integrate transistors in every layer, then these micro bumps are already a huge step forward, but it's still perhaps not fast enough, especially if you think about layering chips on top of each other. So on the future design, what we hope to see is 3D chip stacks. So just imagine you have one wafer or one chip. Let's say this has been manufactured by Intel, and you would now like to be able to connect this to memory as fast as you can. Then one idea is to simply stack some memory chips on top, and build some connections directly between the compute chip and the memory chip. So if you Google for Intel and Micron or 3D chip stack, you will see some hits. Currently, Intel is cooperating with Micron. And interestingly, also NVIDIA. I think the successor of Maxwell, somewhere around that line, is scheduled to have also a 3D chip stack developed by Micron. Basically, the idea is to have a higher memory bandwidth. Does anyone see a problem with stacking these chips on top of each other? Cooling, exactly. So if you think that this chip is going to be hot, these chips probably are going to be hot as well. So how do I cool this chip if I have other chips layered on top of them, which just add more heat? That's a huge problem. I think if you have a limited stack size, this will still work. You just have to cool the topmost chip, and if it's cool enough, the other chips will also be cool enough. At least that is what we hope. Another idea currently being pursued by companies, I think that's even a research project of IBM, is, again, sorry for the slides. The idea is basically to have 3D cooling by adding channels into the die itself, by carving and edging channels into the die itself. And if you have a 3D stack, you can probably even have channels within the stack. So the new idea is to simply pump water through the chip, perhaps water. We don't know. We don't know if it is water. We don't. This is very, very experimental. But something has to happen. If our chips are using more and more power, we need some way to cool it. And even if each chip is not using an increased amount of power, if we are stacking them, the whole stack will need more power. Of course, there are problems, right? If the channels here are too narrow, we need more pressure. If the pressure is too high, the whole chip will blow away. If this water is not very clean, these channels will clog up. So as I said, it's very experimental. There is a prototype working. So this was actually a prototype of a chip which had two valves through which water could be pumped through the chip to cool it down. This is from 2011, so, but it's still not on the market, and I don't think it will be on the market anytime soon. Okay, so the previous slides were on manufacturing. What we don't know is how the architecture of these chips will look like for the future. One particularly interesting project I would like to show you is the NVIDIA Echelon system, or Echelon project, which is also a exascale project. And the basic idea is, if we move data through the chip, this is expensive. You've seen on the previous slides how much wires you need just to drive a single SRAM cell. These wires consume power. It's not so much compute power that we spend our budget now on, but moving data. So the idea is, let's move less data through the chip. Let's enable application developers to keep the data where they need it. Let's have a data hierarchy which can be adapted to the compute problem. So if we would visualize this, the idea is to have more caches directly to the core and be able to reconfigure the other caches. So how could this look like? We could, for instance, have a network on chip and let all the cores decide themselves where they need to route data. So it's less about a high hierarchy, where you sometimes, if you need, let's say this processor needs data from this level one cache, then it has to traverse level two and level three cache. If the other processor is on another branch of a level four cache, it would have to move even farther. But with a network on chip, depending on the network's architecture, it might be able to retrieve the data with just moving through one hop of the network, but not having to traverse the other levels of the cache. That's one idea how you can reduce power consumption. So the idea is, well, why don't we do both? Why don't we have something which we can configure? So sometimes we have a flat hierarchy where data can move directly. Sometimes we have a real hierarchy, which is more suited to traditional workloads. OK, so once this network on chip and the storage architecture is settled, we can think about the core design. And naturally, the original design of Echelon is very close to a GPU. It is an NVIDIA project, after all. So the idea is, well, let's have lots of vector lanes. These are not really intelligent, but they are simple. So I can get lots of floats and don't spend too much energy on instruction scheduling. And if I have a lot of these, I can just add them together to what they call a GPU chip. It is obviously a beefed up GPU targeted for exascale. and the remainder of the system simply to take these chips with where each chip has a lot of, I would call this multiprocessor, because that's simply what it is in GPUs today, which has lots of vector lanes, and these are then scaled up. The assumption would be that this here is one node, this blue curve, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. So initially, NVIDIA said this would be a node, but in recent slides, they have backpedaled and said, well, maybe this is a device, and you may have multiple nodes, multiple devices per node. So let's see. I think that most of the content is still confidential, and these overview slides are actually already 2 or 3 years old, but as far as I know, they have not disclosed anything more, but I know that they're still receiving funding, so they are likely still working on this. Okay, so other manufacturers have other ideas, but what we very often see is 2D networks on a chip. So this network on a chip is not an idea which just NVIDIA clings to, but actually it's a very broad idea of many research projects and manufacturers. If you remember the IBM cell processor, you may still remember that the cell processor had lots of compute units, actually 8 vector units, and they were all connected via a ring bus. Also on the ring bus was the scalar unit, the power processing element, and the memory controller, and some other devices. The problem of this design was that the ring bus somewhere didn't scale. Some of the compute units were simply much further away from the memory controller than others, and the ring bus used to be overloaded. And then along came Intel with the with the Knight's Corner design, I think. And the Knight's Corner design had a ring bus. And the ring bus did not have just 8 units, but 50 units. And people said, OK, that's going to be easily programmable. But the result was the ring bus, again, was a bottleneck. So what I think, what we can say about the future is we will see fewer ring buses and more 2D meshes on a chip. Basically, how these chips look like is you always get a lot of cores. Let's just assume we'll have 16 cores, right? And the interconnect connects every core to each direct neighbor. I won't draw all connections right now, so it will look something like this. So if this core needs to talk to this core, it will have to pass the message through other nodes, through other cores. Pretty logical. So it is just a logical extension of the ring bus concept. That's why a lot of startups also dabble in this. So if you have ever heard about Adaptiva Epiphany, so Adaptiva is the company, Epiphany is the product, or Telera, these companies also design multi-cores or many-cores, as they call them. I think Adaptiva did also have a Kickstarter project where they said, hey, you can buy a supercomputer for the poor man from us. I think their boards are rather cheap. By the time they were available on the market, their performance was inferior to a current GPU. So it was not really a supercomputer. It was a many-core computer, but it was not super. The Telera products are not really a product for the supercomputing market, because their goal was something like network routers. So their cores did not have floating point units. You can imagine without floating point units, this hardware is not much good for high performance computing. Intel once had this Intel single chip cloud computer, a terrible name because it's terribly misleading. But this was also was more of a, this was never really marketed, but it was a research project where they took old Pentium cores and put them on a in a 2D mesh, and we applied for compute time on these systems, but we didn't get one. Sorry. The next product they had was Knight's Corner, which is the current Intel Xeon Phi. This doesn't have a 2D mesh as a set, but it has just a ring bus. And the next product, which they will launch, Knight's Landing, will have a 2D mesh. So let's take a more detailed look at some of the designs. So this is a print of the Epiphany block diagram. And what you can see here is these are individual cores, and they are connected to the neighboring cores. And usually, what you can see is each core has some sort of local memory, very similar to the vector units on the cell. And what's missing here is obviously the bus controller and the memory controller. So memory controllers are typically on the outer edges of the die. There's one problem, though. If I have the memory controllers just on the edge, then this, again, will be a bottleneck. Because let's assume the memory controllers are here, then these nodes will be much further away from the memory controller than these. And either you have to over-provide the on-chip network with bandwidth so that each, even the further distant cores, have sufficient bandwidth, or you have to test the programmer with scheduling computations in such a way that these cores pass intermediate results to other cores, which then complete the computation. So it's going to be difficult for the programmer. At least that's my assumption. Either expensive hardware, power-hungry hardware, or difficult to program. This is a block diagram of the Tile GX processor by Tilera. And here you can again see that usually I/O is on the edges. Memory controller, again, is on the edges. So the cores here on the middle won't have direct access to either. For their special work case, this seems to be working. If I think about supercomputing software where people are even struggling with vectorization, where they are still struggling with standard GPUs, which we have today, this is going to be complicated. Okay, this is a top view of the Intel single chip cloud computer. Again, really misleading title, but that was their architecture. Now, what will be there in the future? The next product from Intel, the Knight's Corner, based Intel Xeon Phi, Knight's Landing. I did include this slide to give you an overview of what will change. We are part of, our chair is part of a research program with Intel, so there is a lot of information floating around currently which has not been publicly disclosed, but if you have not signed an NDA, then you might want to look at this page where they have summarized what is currently published, so you know that what you can say to the public, which you are actually allowed to, and you don't have to be afraid to be sued. So for instance, if I would now tell you all the details we heard in some meetings, I would probably have to be afraid that our university would be sued by Intel. Anyhow, so what are the key differences between the two designs? Luckily, the really interesting parts have already been disclosed. So what's going to change is, first of all, we'll have more cores, of course. It's not so much a step up. It's just 10 cores more. But each core will be much more capable. So these will be based no longer on the ancient Pentium design, which is really literally the old Pentium design, which was published, I think, 15 years ago. But this will be based on a newer Atom microarchitecture, the Silvermont microarchitecture. So this is out of order. I think 4x simultaneous multithreading, hyperthreading, as it's called, is new. The same vector unit, or the same vector width as the previous design. But what's also interesting is it will be available as a PCI Express card, and there will be also sockets. So you will be able to put a Knight's Landing onto your main board directly if you want to. It's also it's going to be binary compatible to, I think, Ivy Bridge, or no, even Haswell. So it will be binarily compatible with current Intel Xeon processors. So you don't even have to recompile your code to run on such a chip. You can use the same binary. At least that is what they say. They did say it about Knight's Corner as well, and theoretically you could, but what you would observe is that on Knight's Corner, some optimized generic code would actually run slower than on the Intel Xeon processor. So we'll see how well this will fare with Knight's Landing. It will definitely be interesting to see these compete with GPUs. Okay, so brief break for me. I did mention before the problem of dark silicon. I have slowly, or I think the die size has remained fixed over the past years. My integration density is still rising, so I have more transistors, but I still have the same thermal budget for each chip. So one question is, if I can't fire all my transistors simultaneously, is this leading to a problem? Or should I perhaps rearrange my architecture so that I can still use it somewhat efficiently? And one alternative approach is this 10 by 10 approach. And the idea is, before I explain the idea, what is the current problem with our current CPUs? Basically, we have very different workloads. This is just an abstraction, right? But if you know anything about computing, you know that there are, for instance, linear algebra applications, which are very different from n-body simulations, which are very different from stencil codes, right? So these differ not just in the computational intensity, but also in the model, in the way data flows through the compute system and which application or which computations are applied. This is also the reason why, for specific workloads, GPUs outperform standard CPUs by a high margin. But simultaneously, there are other workloads where CPUs are much faster than a GPU. And our problem is basically that we have general purpose CPUs, which are optimized for the common case, right? But they are not very efficient for other workloads. So what we can see here in the common case is we have something like instruction level parallelism, locality in the data, linear access for our larger arrays, and such things. And we have some generic optimizations, but they are not always very efficient. And that's also interesting. The standard architectures we see are somewhat bloated in the sense that older CPUs just had a few instructions. And because we have to keep backwards compatibility, newer releases still have the same instructions, but added more. Sometimes not a lot, but yeah. So in theory, you could have even more instructions on currently Nehalem, which is, I think, now three generations old. I had more than 500 instructions. I think today we have more than 600 instructions. So really a lot of instructions. And so the decoding logic, the instruction scheduler, gets more and more complicated. And this is, of course, not efficient. Actually, I think you can't even buy this. So this is not just Photoshop work. I think you can even buy this on Amazon. In one of the previous years, I did open my browser to see if it was really available. And I accidentally added it to my cart on Amazon. And then days later, when I was ordering something from Amazon, and I was surprised that it was what I had in my cart was costing more than 900 euros. And that was just because I had still this knife in my cart. Yeah. So I won't open my browser now because I don't want this to repeat. Okay, so what's the idea of this 10 by 10 approach? Basically, the idea is not have this complex core which is optimized for everything, but to have a simpler core which is specialized. And because the simpler core is smaller, we can have more cores, much more cores. One example for this idea is our GPUs. GPUs have simpler cores, and that is why we have thousands of shaders on a GPU today, and not some 10 cores. BlueJean is the same idea. It's an embedded processor, very simple, with wide vector units. Mobile phones have also four cores. I have four cores in my mobile phone, and I have four cores in my notebook. But this is obviously much smaller. It's also less capable, okay, yeah, right, because it's not optimized for the general case. There's another slide on the 10 by 10 approach, which also highlights another problem of the scale-up of these out-of-order cores. If we scale these, probably the power density will grow too large, so we won't be able to integrate 16 or more cores of standard cores on the die. Right now, I think the maximum which Intel is selling is 18 cores, but these are already downclocked. So it's very unlikely that we will see such chips for a notebook. Okay, I think we did already talk about this. Okay, so how does this 10 by 10 approach differ, right? Until now, I've just been talking about the problems of the traditional approach. The idea of the 10 by 10 approach is basically, these are tools, right? So why have all these tools in one? Why don't we optimize, or why don't we get optimized tools for each workload? So the idea is, if we have specialized cores, these can be 10 times faster or 10 times more energy efficient. We can see this for some designs which are already on the market. So for instance, GPUs are much more efficient for graphics than traditional CPUs. Even Intel is agreeing with this because they are adding specialized graphics cores to their own notebook chips. So no one's trying to do graphics with a general purpose multi-core. There's always specialized hardware. Even on my mobile phone, there's a dedicated graphics core. So obviously, graphics are an example where we can get a huge performance and energy advantage if we are using dedicated designs. Another design from the supercomputing market is this Grape DR design. That is a specialized supercomputer for n-body simulations. Another interesting example would be Anton. Anton is also a specialized supercomputer for long-running n-body simulations, which has been developed by D.E. Shaw Research. Did I tell you the story of D.E. Shaw Research? I'm not sure if we have enough time today, but we can probably talk about this tomorrow. So remind me of that, and it's an interesting story. So what I'm trying to say is specialized tools have a huge advantage for specialized workloads. So why don't we factor our applications, which are not necessarily so diverse. So if you are working on supercomputing software, you already probably know different cases of applications. Why don't we then develop accelerators for each class of applications, which is much more efficient than a standard core, and then compose those? So one new unit of compute would consist of very different cores. And depending on which application is running on this, it will deliver a highly improved performance, power-wise and also in terms of computational speed. So this is, of course, not theoretical. So actually, this is, again, a photo. It's a slightly better quality than the previous pictures because I had my camera with me. And this is one example how we could how we could cluster the SPEC benchmarks. As you know, SPEC is basically a suite of different benchmarks, and we could cluster them to N-body simulations or dense linear algebra, MapReduce, graph traversal, and so on, finite state machines. And if we had specialized hardware, which we obviously can design, this would be beneficial to the resulting CPU. Now, if we have composed such a macro core, then again, we can cluster these macro cores on an ASIC. And because in our macro core, only one part of the hardware will be active, depending on the currently running application, it's not really a problem that we have dark silicon, because we were initially not planning to use all the hardware, not all the transistors, but just parts of it. So we can live with the increased power density. Right? But because we are only using these specialized cores, it will still be it will still deliver an increased performance. That is, again, that is at least the idea. I'm not sure if anyone's really pursuing this, but from a architecture point of view, from a theoretical point of view, this is really interesting. One obvious question here is, why not use FPGAs? If you know anything, do you know what FPGAs are? Field programmable gate arrays. The basic idea is that it's reconfigurable hardware which you can reprogram at runtime, so you can implement different structures. And even at our department, we have a lot of research projects which focus on FPGAs. And the question is, why wouldn't we use FPGAs? Why use ASICs? And the result is FPGAs are about 10 times inferior to ASICs if you have the same power and the same chip size compared to ASICs, simply because the way FPGAs implement logical functions is rather indirect. They store them in SRAM cells. So it's not really hardware which is reconfigured, but it's more or less they store logical functions in small memories. Is that about correct, what I'm saying? I think, yes. Okay, so I think you know more about FPGAs, but still the, but still that's more or less a fact. If you have an ASIC, it will be more efficient than FPGA. There are a lot of use cases where FPGAs are superior to multicores, right? But if you compare them with an ASIC, the ASIC will always win. Okay, so actually this already concludes our brief glimpse into the future, which I was trying. I think we still have some more minutes, and I would like to spend some minutes on looking at power consumption. What's currently one limiting factor for the size of supercomputers is power consumption. If you go back 10 or 20 years, the limiting factor was the budget for acquiring a supercomputer. Because these machines were always expensive, but power consumption was not so much of an issue, because power used to be cheap, and also the machines did not used to use too much power. But because supercomputers have grown faster than Moore's law, also the power consumption went up. So today, I think about half of the budget is spent on power consumption and cooling and basically how to keep the machine running. And acquiring the machine is not so much of an issue as it used to be. So, how can we solve this problem? The best solution, of course, would be to avoid heat altogether. So this is actually one of the approaches of our local computing center. We don't have such a large machine, but we have experts who will teach physicists, chemists, how to optimize the code to run at a higher efficiency. So that's always the best solution. If people can use a system more efficiently, then less heat will be generated, because less cores will spend waiting on other cores, which is usually a spin lock. So they are actually consuming power while not doing any useful computation. And so often there is a sort of 10x potential in codes. This is just a rough number. Usually you would think I can't imagine any supercomputing code at running at just 10% of the peak performance, but reality is it's often much less than 10% of the peak performance. But if you are able to properly tune it, if you have someone who's proficient in performance engineering, then you can get huge speed up. What also would be an advantage is energy-aware middleware. So if you have a batch scheduler and good power management, you should be able to switch off nodes which are currently idling, or you should be able to move computations to nodes which currently have a different thermal budget than other nodes. But if you can't avoid the heat, and obviously we can't avoid all of the heat, then we have to find an efficient way to remove excess heat. And first we have to get the heat out of the server room, and then we have to get the heat out of the coolant, which are actually two different problems. And as said before, some buildings are simply not suitable to all kinds of cooling, for instance, ours. So if we have air cooling, we can have different setups. One is the traditional setup, which is grossly inefficient, but it is, for instance, used in our own department's server room, which is why we have a lot of problems in the summer. The traditional setup is we have a raised floor. On the raised floor, we have racks. These racks consume air and consume cold air and produce hot air. And what we feed the system with cold air through the raised floor. And our cooling consumes the hot air and cools it down. Now, why is this grossly inefficient? Because the cool air from the from the raised floor mixes directly with the hot air, which is exhausted by the systems. So if you want the nodes on top of the rack to still remain cool, we have to keep this air cool enough that even after it has mixed with the other nodes' air, it's still cool enough to cool down these nodes. Grossly inefficient. So one approach to improve this cooling concept is to use a hot aisle, cold aisle concept. My idea is, let's not mix cold air and hot air, but instead, two columns of racks are always facing each other, and we are now directing the flow of air. So all these two racks will pump the hot air into their middle, into their center, and now we are simply sealing this off. This is what we call a hot aisle. Of course, we cannot seal this completely, because then it would explode, right? So that's not good. But if we have this hot air concentrated, then we can construct an air guide which guides the hot air to the cooling system. So the hot air will never mix with the cold air. And the cold air won't enter the hot aisle through the raised floor, but it will enter the server room just through the cold aisles. So if we have more racks, let's say here are more racks, I would always group rows of racks to one hot aisle so that I have cold air in the cold aisles and hot air just in the hot aisles. And this alone can already save you about half of your cooling costs. Very simple. It's even in our server room, not in our server room, but in the compute center's server room, they have built these hot aisle, cold aisle concept, where they are concentrating hot air. Okay, but even that is sort of limited, right? So another approach would be water cooling. One approach which we have for the Lima cluster is cold water, as I said before. That is problematic in some sense, but it's also beneficial because it's more efficient to cool. You don't have to build a hot aisle, cold aisle setup. But somewhere you need a supply of cold water. So a lot of compute centers have recently opened in countries like Newfoundland, Finland, Canada, wherever they are close to the sea, where the sea is actually cold, when they don't have a lot of risk of tsunamis and whatnot. Typically, they have two circuits, one internal circuit with very clean water, and one external circuit with unprocessed or lightly filtered water. The reason for this is, if you think about Supermux, where water was actually piped to the CPUs directly, you don't want contamination in those pipes. You don't want a dolphin to enter these pipes because it will probably clog the pipes, right? So that's why you typically have, if you use cold water or ambient water, then you typically have two circuits. Another approach would be hot water. So one advantage of hot water is it's usually cheaper to cool hot water to a slightly lower temperature than to have the same temperature difference, but to cool it below ambient temperatures. That is expensive. That's actually the reason why our cold water is so expensive. And at LRZ, where they're using hot water cooling, it's much cheaper. Also, you don't get the same problems with condensation water, and you can reuse waste heat. If you can't reuse waste heat, for instance, in summer and no one is really turning up the heating in the office because they're not brain dead, then you still can use free air cooling. Even in our latitude. Yeah, I think this was a reference to people thinking that the world would end 2012. I probably should take out that joke. Okay, one example would be a Google data center in Finland. And this is actually an old paper mill. Does anyone have an idea why they were using an old paper mill? Sorry?
Maybe it's close to water.
Yes, exactly. Why is it close to water? Because you need lots of water for producing paper. So they actually even had a water tunnel from the site to, what is fjord in English? Okay, well, so let's say they had a water tunnel to the sea, right? But they had lots of water. And what you can see here is, can we perhaps switch off the light? Okay, that's much better. Okay, so what you can see here in the different colors of the tubes, so this should be blue, this is yellow. I think this is the water intake, this is the water exhaust, and this is a heat exchanger. And they are using two different circuits. One, as I said, lightly filtered for external water, and one for their own water. Yep. So another compute center, this is in Sweden, and it was planned by Facebook. This is also very close to the Arctic Circle, and they also use ambient temperatures to cool their data center. What's also interesting is, usually if you move to Scandinavia, but also to Canada, it's easy to get hydropower. So that's a very stable power supply, and it's also friendly to the environment. So everyone will like you if you build data centers like this. Now in Germany, we are not in Scandinavia. We don't have access to lots of hydropower. If you build hydropower power plants, then people won't say, oh, this is environmentally friendly, but they will say, I don't want you to flood my village. Also, our ambient temperatures are not low enough to for most cooling ideas. So what should we do? This is the Leibniz Rechenzentrum. And This building here is actually the Rechnerwürfel. So that was just built for the high-performance computing system. And I was there once for a workshop. And what I found most interesting was actually that here, connecting these buildings, which are built for the staff and students, there's a huge hall. And inside these halls, they have a very efficient means of transportation, namely pipes. So if you're there in the second floor, or I think in English I should say third floor, but in German it's zweites Obergeschoss, you can either choose the stairs to walk down, or you can just go through this pipe. And it doesn't look very steep, but if you're standing on top of it, it looks like almost vertical. So, if you're ever at Leibniz Rechenzentrum, I really suggest you to go through these pipes. It's a lot of fun, but you should watch that on the top, on the bottom of the pipes, there are usually some rags. Take one of these rags with you, because you're not allowed to go through these pipes without a rag. Why not? If you're going down here, you will generate a lot of friction. And if you look at the racks, actually where people are resting their foot, these racks are already burned because of the friction. So if you go down this pipe without a rack, it's pretty likely that your clothing will be damaged. So yeah, always take a rack with you. I did go up without a rack because I didn't know about this. And so I was standing on top of that and thought, okay, I can't go down. And I had to go down the stairs again, fetch a rack, go up again. That was not very efficient, but it's a lot of fun. I think the building's even open to visitors, even in the evening. So if you want to ride some pipes here, you can just go there. I think you don't even need a license. This blue cloth here is the rack which you can use. And if you look very closely, like I can now, you can even see the marks where it's slowly burned. Yeah, but a very, very beautiful facility. And if you remember that our Hochhaus, Informatikhaus, Hochhaus here, this building was closed for the better part of the term because of the Brandschutzbestimmung, so the regulations are according how the building could be evacuated. I was always thinking, wouldn't it be cheaper than to exile all the chairs to different neighboring cities? Wouldn't it be cheaper to just add these pipes? So let's say to every second or to every third floor, we could have just such a pipe which is going down the building. It certainly would be much more fun. And because it is a pipe, you don't have to worry about weather. You don't have to worry about snow or water, because it's already isolated. And I think it would even make the building more attractive. But that's just my view. Directly go to the network. Exactly. Or to the bus station. I like that idea.
It's not like in every direction.
Depending on where the fire is, people could choose different pipes. Yeah. So that's good. Yes. Obviously, you need, because you don't want to enter the pipe when someone from six stories above you is already in there and would just crash into you. So maybe we need even vector processing in the sense of multiple pipelines. It's a lot of ideas to extend this. Actually, we have our blinds down all the time of the year, because either it's winter and it's already too dark in our office, or it's summer and the sun is just baking us alive. So basically, we don't want any ambient light to enter our room, at least without air cooling. So I would be fine with a pipe just passing my window. That would be cool. Okay, let's talk a bit about the LRZ and how they have achieved their very efficient power utilization value. So first, let's talk about power, because somewhere you need power, right? Basically, they have a 10 megawatts. Is it really 10 megavolt? Okay, so let's just assume they have power, right? They have redundant power lines, and that's good. If if the power supply fails. We need some backup power, and they have some uninterruptible power supplies, which are basically flywheels. Do you know what a flywheel is? In German, that would be Schwungrad. So that's a huge. It's a huge wheel, mostly of steel, which is just spinning and spinning and spinning. Mostly, it's actually not vertical, but horizontal placed. And while it's not generating power, it's just spinning, and some motor keeps it spinning. And because it's spinning so fast, it will even levitate a bit. So it's actually, it's got a bearing, but it's floating. It's levitating. If the power supply breaks down and you want to generate power from this flywheel, the motors which keep it spinning is working like a generator, or in German, Dynamo, right? So you can do this with pretty much every electronic motor. The problem is, if this is not spinning very fast anymore, because you've removed all the kinetic energy and converted to electrical energy, this will come down crashing into the bearing. And if you think that such a flywheel is heavy, then this will shake your building. Do you have any idea how heavy such a flywheel might be? Depends on the flywheel itself, depends on how much energy you can store in this, but about 1 to 2 tons. So it's not light. And actually, those flywheels were built into the building before the basement was completed. So they have no opportunity to remove these flywheels anymore from the building, since the basement has now been completed. So it's built into the building. They also have diesel generators. So they actually have the static UPS is based on batteries. They have some chillers on top of the building. I think if we move back some slides, we can even see those on the Rechnerwürfel. So these structures here are chillers and evaporators. They are put on the top side of the building. And I think you can also see some cooling facilities. If you go to our building, to the third floor or above, you can see those on the roof of the second floor. And as I said before, they're using warm water cooling. So they have a 40 degrees Celsius inlet temperature, and they can use ambient air to cool it down. This is another view of the flywheel, so that's more exact than what I drew on the blackboard. What you can see in the center is the motor, and this is the hub, and this is the rotor. So it's not really a flat wheel, but it's rather a cylinder which is spinning. And of course, it's spinning in vacuum. So it's not levitating because of some air drag, but it's levitating because of the magnetic forces which keep it, the magnetic bearings. But still, if this crashes into the bearings, that can be a problem. Okay, previously I was saying that originally the older machines had a very unbiased cost for the investment, the procurement, and the power consumption later on. So here the factor is about 1 to 10, right? Heil RB2, which was inaugurated in 2006, so about 6 years later. Here we already had a factor of 1 to 5. Still not that important. Still, these 7 million euros was much less than 35 million euros for procurement. But when SuperMOOC was procured in 2012, and we are almost through its usage period, so I think in the next year we'll see a new system. the procurement cost has not risen considerably, right? This is just, what is it, 1/4, 1/3 more. But power consumption almost tripled. So it is now a huge factor. And it is also a huge factor even in the US, where power is much cheaper. So even in the US, people are now interested in reducing power consumption of supercomputers. And there's one more reason why it would be interesting to reduce power consumption. Typically, you cannot build a supercomputer to an arbitrary size. Typically, you're limited to probably the size of a small gymnasium. Because if the supercomputer gets even larger, then your networking cables will also need to grow longer, and then you get troubles with the network latency. So you want your system to be densely integrated. But if your system is densely integrated and you're increasing its the number of nodes you have in the system, then you will have basically more heat in the same space. And if your heat density exceeds a certain point, then you can't even remove the excess heat with water cooling. So that's one reason why power consumption is also not just a factor for a monetary factor. It's not just a problem for paying the bills, but it's also a problem for the construction itself. Okay, so I think we are now over time. So I will upload these slides, so you have a reference. But I think we are now through the really important part of the lecture. As I said before, tomorrow for the exercise we'll meet, and I briefly skim through the chapters of the lecture and tell you what's important for the exam and what's probably not so important. So for instance, any slide beyond this is not important for the exam because we simply didn't cover it in the lecture. So that's it from my side for today. Thank you very much for being here, and see you tomorrow.